Thanks for downloading from WRTI. This is Jim Cotter. For more information on this and all the other programming you hear on the station, go to our website, wrti.org. While you're there, you might consider becoming a member, renewing your membership, or making an additional gift. This podcast and all of the programming you hear on WRTI is made possible by our listener members. Why not become one now? Thanks, and enjoy the show.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
This week, the Philadelphia Orchestra welcomed the celebrated British conductor Sir Roger Norrington. He leads the ensemble in performances of Beethoven's Symphony No. 4, Mozart's Bassoon Concerto, and Schumann's Symphony No. 1. For the Mozart Concerto, the orchestra's principal bassoon, Dainu Matsukawa, comes to the front of the stage to take the lead role in what is one of the most celebrated and popular works for his instrument. Though scholars believe Mozart wrote two more bassoon concertos, only this, his first, survives. Though there are a significant number of concertos for the bassoon, Vivaldi wrote almost 40, the most often performed besides the Mozart are those of von Weber and Hummel. When I met with Dainu Matsukawa backstage at the orchestra's summer home in Saratoga Springs earlier this year, he told me how important a role this piece has played in his musical life. He performed it in his winning audition for the Philadelphia Orchestra, and the work, composed when Mozart was just 18, has been with Matsukawa since he was even younger.
Mozart wrote this when he was 18. For a lot of composers, this would be an early work, not for him, because he had clearly been writing for a number of years at this point. How musically sophisticated is this for an 18-year-old, albeit an 18-year-old genius?
It's very sophisticated, and rumor has it that he wrote it as kind of like a joke. He wanted it to be impossible to be performed, unplayable by any bassoonist, and that's why it includes all these leaps and bounds in within the first movement, and it's very, very athletic and almost acrobatic, a lot of arpeggios and a lot of 16th note passages. And so the second movement is very operatic, and I love the second movement very much. In fact, people think the Marriage of Figaro, Act 2, is quoted from the second movement, but it's very similar, it's very close to the melody. And then the third movement is a waltz, and it's also beautiful. So one of my first teachers said, a concerto isn't just like allegro, fast, andante, slow movement, back to allegro. He said allegro is more like happy. So the first movement is very joyful. Second movement, he would always say, is like a love song. So this is, again, it is truly a love song and very operatic indeed. And then the third movement is a dance. So it's not just, again, allegro again. So and I always liked that. That stuck with me for years. So that's usually my approach when performing this kind of work.
Rumored that he wrote two other bassoon concerti.
I don't want to think about that. It drives me crazy to think about that.
But did he know how to write for the bassoon? You say this is a joke, but
did he understand
the mechanics of your instrument?
I think so. I mean, I could only imagine back then it was probably an impossible task. I mean, now I'm just imagining that the bassoon back then were like, if you can bear with me, probably like six tone holds and one key. And now we have the same six tone holds, but we also have a number of other keys. So the modern instrument, the modernization of the bassoon has helped a lot, but it's still quite difficult in many ways. Not to mention musically speaking, the saying is true that you cannot hide behind Mozart. You can't. It's just so open and bare that there's no faking, there's no pretentiousness at all. It's all very true. What you hear is what you get, and that's what makes Mozart very hard. It's very pure.
Besides your, as it turned out, successful audition with the Philadelphia Orchestra, what else does this piece evoke for you? It's something that's clearly been you've been carrying around for a very long time.
Yes. I would say that the three main concertos is the Mozart Person Concerto, the von Weber Concerto, which I was lucky to play here with the orchestra a few years ago. And then there's the Hummel Concerto, like the famous Hummel Trumpet Concerto. There's one for bassoon, also a really wonderful piece. Those, I would say, are the three main concertos for bassoon in the main repertoire. They're often asked at auditions for school admissions, entrance exams, juries, and required and most many syllabus. And I think people then think, oh, well, that's all there was. I mean, we have so many violin concertos, so many piano concertos. And then I'm always arguing with them. No, there are actually a lot of bassoon concertos, but those were the three. Then there are a lot of 20th century concertos, concerti, which are all, I don't really have a particular fondness for them. There are some good pieces, but a lot of them, I joke about this with a lot of composers when I ask them, could you someday write a bassoon concerto? But I don't want a bassoon concerto. And they're like, what do you mean? I would tell them, I want something lyrical. I don't want something bouncy. Like everyone thinks, you know, they associate Fantasia and or Sources Apprentice with a bassoon, and it's like Humpty Dumpty, and it's like, you know, bop, 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 bop.
Heel-topping.
Yeah, and that's what and I don't know why that is. And the Weber concerto is not like that. The Mozart concerto, Hummel, they're all very beautiful, again, technically difficult too, but also they're just not like very clown-like and bouncy in that way. But for some reason, something happened in the 20th century, and a lot of composers love to write that sort of comical effect for the bassoon. And Maestro Eschenbach was he and I were talking at one point about perhaps commissioning, getting the orchestra to write a work, and he understood right away. He's like, okay, so we will have a concerto for not bassoon. Like he would call it something like a non-bassoon concerto.
For bassoon.
But, yes, for bassoon. But it would have to be very lyrical. And so going back to this, I mean, Vivaldi wrote 38 bassoon concerti, which no one, you know, knows about. People perform them a lot, but they only think they're about 5 or 10 at most. But there are 38 that he wrote. And it's not one concerto with 37 variations. It's actually like...
37 separate pieces of music.
Yeah, and it's... also, rumor has it that he was in love with someone who liked the bassoon and liked the sound of the bassoon. And him being a red priest, you know, he could... I guess he had his things with this. He taught at this female school. But anyway, someone he was in love with loved the bassoon, and I'm very grateful to that person. And because of that person, I think he was able to you know, sort of woo his way through his music. Okay, so back to the Mozart bassoon concerto. I'm sorry, go on a tangent here. The concerto is probably the most famous bassoon concerto. I was in Japan the other day in a department store, and I heard the Mozart bassoon concerto. Like, and I was like laughing, like no way. And then, not too long ago,
it wasn't you playing it, was it?
No.
Would you have known?
I would have known. And I've recorded it once, but it was a live performance with Maestro Gergiev conducting at a Pacific Music Festival in a summer festival. But I also heard it on an airplane, like not too long ago as well. So it is a famous bassoon concerto, and I have two small kids, and I recently bought a classical music CD, and there's a Mozart, baby Mozart thing, and there it is, like the first movement. There's Eine kleine Nacht music, all these famous, and the first movement of the Mozart bassoon concerto. So I had no idea that it was actually like a little more popular than I had given it credit. So I started bassoon when I was 13, and then I played a competition about a year later, a year and a half, and it was my first big competition, and it was the first movement of the Mozart bassoon concerto, and I won that competition. I don't like to be boastful. I don't mean to. But I do have a history with this piece in that it's close to my heart, and it was one of the first pieces that I got to know on the bassoon, learn and love. And I thought, like, wow, if all music is like this, then I'm really lucky, and I have a nice long road ahead of me. But it was a really great way to get to learn the instrument and know the instrument. And you know, of course, over the years I got to play with a few various orchestras. But the Mozart and Weber are up there for me. Like I have an equal affinity for the Weber concerto, and it's very operatic in a different way.
But do you have that sense of it having grown in your hands? Because clearly, the reaction of an 8-year-old to a Mozart bassoon concerto and that of a older person mm-hmm. or somebody of your age yeah. is very different. Do you feel it different every time you play it?
Absolutely, sure. I think, and I tell this to my students, the way you learn it now and play it, it's not going to be the same. And it's, I think we're all students for life and for in every, area of our lives. And I think definitely for, our music making, definitely for Mozart, I think with there are many interpretations of this piece. There are many additions in terms of the music and scores. A lot of people write their own articulations. But Mozart, it is very interpretive. I try to find my way. This is how I'll try to best describe it, how I try to teach it, is I tell my students, I am not a Mozartian scholar. I didn't go to Salzburg. I didn't study his manuscripts in and out, backwards and forwards. But to my best knowledge, I try to play in a way that is in a classical style, the best way I can. Again, what does that mean? What I do know is, again, not being a Mozartian scholar, is that it's has to be different than the way we play Wagner. It has to be different than the way we play Brahms. And so I try to tell my students, and also friends and colleagues, like when they're taking auditions, the hardest thing about auditions is that we have to go from Bach to Stravinsky and then jump back to Beethoven and then to Bartok and then to Mozart, and all within 5 minutes. And it's absolutely cruel what they do to us. And we have to wear different hats. And it's like you're an actor and like, okay, now cry. Okay, now laugh. Okay, now show pain. Now show joy. And all with these different emotions. And it's like that. But what I try to tell them is sometimes people come in and they'll play with a great sound, a great rhythm, great pitch, great intonation, great everything, great musicality, great phrasing, but everything sounds the same. And I tell them they have to pay respects to the different composers, the different eras, periods. Even Tchaikovsky, Brahms lived around the same time. Completely different sound, different style. One is dark, the other one's rich. I mean, we can try to scientifically put a finger on it, but I don't like to do that either. So, again, I try to tell my students there's a difference between a Brahms staccato, short note, and a Mozart staccato, and the length of notes. And sometimes there's a good rule of thumb. Sometimes there's a general style of playing these pieces. So as I approach the Mozart concerto again, I still try to, each time I revisit it, I still try to have that general sense of I want to have this classical style. I may play around. I'm sure I'll feel differently next week than how I'll play it today. As I start to get reacquainted and sort of rekindle this old flame, I will try to bring with me, different new ideas, I've grown a lot. I also tell people, it sounds like a funny thing, but if I'm about to perform and I could map every note and try to play it and try to shape it in my head, and I'll be different anyway. Like, even if I try, and it's a challenge to try to make it the same way, which I don't think is a good thing anyway. We want to have spontaneity. But I would tell them, if my wife forgets to peck me on the cheek, I will play it differently that day. I mean, you never really know. But given that, yes, I absolutely know for a fact that how I'm going to perform it this year will be different than how I last performed it, and will be different than how I will perform it in another year to come.
The Philadelphia Orchestra's principal bassoon, Daniel Matsukawa, in a program that also includes Beethoven Symphony No. 4 and Schumann Symphony No. 1. He's the soloist for Mozart's Bassoon Concerto. Performances are at 8 o'clock this evening and tomorrow afternoon at 2 at the Kimmel Center's Verizon Hall.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
Next week, the Philadelphia-based Baroque Orchestra Tempesta di Mare opens a season in which it will perform the complete cycle of Johann Sebastian Bach's Brandenburg Concertos. The concertos have been played in concert for over two centuries and have also been adopted by modern popular culture for use in television programs and film scores. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis considers how Tempesta di Mare is using the Brandenburg concertos to highlight other works in the Baroque repertoire that are hardly known at all.
Like a recurring theme in one of his musical compositions, a bit of mystery is woven through the history of Bach's famous set of concertos.
The story is that he put together a set of six concertos, all for the Margrave of Brandenburg.
Temple University Associate Music Professor Stephen Zone says we don't really know why.
We don't really know if Bach was trying to get a job or just money.
The Margrave was a minor nobleman who lived in Berlin. At the time, Bach had worked his way up from church organist to court music director, first for the Duke of Weimar, then for the Prince at Cöthen. He was in his mid-30s and was composing a variety of fugues, preludes, music for clavier, and concertos. But as for the Brandenburgs, Zone says we don't know actually when they were written, because even though the dedication manuscript to the Margrave was dated 1721...
We have early versions of a few pieces, and stylistically some people claim, well, some of these pieces could have been as much as 10 years old by that time. So he may have just opened his drawer, rummaged around for some old pieces, or maybe composed a new movement here or there, one or two new concertos, stuck it together and say, here's the set.
Originally titled Six Concerts with Many Instruments, the concertos are different from one another and from other concertos at the time. They demonstrate a range of innovative forms and instrumentation. Number 4 is for two recorders, solo violin and strings. Number 5 for flute, violin and harpsichord.
Qualifies the piece as the earliest concerto that has a solo keyboard in it. Number 3 is for 9 string instruments. Number 6 has no violins at all. It's violas and viola da gambas. So it's very, very strange. Number 2 has the unusual, maybe even unlikely combination of recorder, oboe, violin, and trumpet, instruments that don't normally go together. So it's clear that he's pushing the envelope.
Exploring the variety in Baroque music also drives the ensemble Tempesta di Mare, an orchestra now in its 8th season that grew out of solo and chamber performances by founders Richard Stone and Gwyn Roberts.
We named the group after Vivaldi's concerto, La Tempesta di Mare, which means a storm at sea.
And we chose that name because it reflects the belief of composers of that time that music could evoke drama.
With connections to libraries and archives in Europe, they sometimes unearth and transcribe music that, because of loss or damage, hasn't been heard by modern audiences. Sinfonia in G by Christoph Graupner was one modern premiere. To listeners today who don't think of Baroque music as inherently dramatic, Gwyn Roberts says that the performance practice was very different then from what it became.
Composers didn't write down a lot of the expression that they wanted in their music because it was a part of the expected vocabulary of players at the time. And one of the things that happened during the 20th century, people started playing Baroque music in what they were calling the pure way, which was they played only the notes on the page, adding nothing. And that's half of the story.
Robert says the performers provide the other half, expression, color, and dynamics, as well as improvisation in the basso continuo, which is a figured bass part played by a keyboard instrument such as an organ or harpsichord.
We as performers have a language of strongs and weaks and louds and softs and lights and darks. And if you think about Baroque painting, it's all about lights and darks and big gestures and sweeping images and dramatic things.
Richard Stone says another analogy would be acting.
And in fact, we think of ourselves sort of along the same lines as an ensemble theater company. You think of something like Shakespeare. You can just read it exactly as it is, monotone, or you can start to imbue it with character. And we're doing something like that with music. The difference is that the words are concrete in their meaning and the music is abstract.
Tempesta di Mare musicians play on modern copies of period instruments and are led not by a conductor, but by three section leaders. Richard Stone leads the instruments playing continuo, concertmaster Emlyn Nye the strings, and Gwyn Roberts the winds. Together, they have a musical conversation. This season, over the course of four concerts, the ensemble is performing all six of the varied Brandenburg concertos, with each program featuring lesser-known works with which the particular Bach concerto shares characteristics.
We're using these Brandenburg concertos as an entry point for people to music that they probably have never heard before.
Although he has his own personal style, Bach is not on a planet separate from the rest of the universe. Bach exists in context.
There is no record of any performing parts or any other evidence that the six concertos Bach dedicated to the Margrave of Brandenburg were ever played in those years. After the Margrave's death in 1734, the score was sold for a small amount and disappeared for a time until it was discovered in the mid-1800s. In the years since, they've become just about the most popular and highly regarded music from the Baroque era. And it seems somehow fitting that this once-lost music, shrouded in mystery, is being used by Tempesta di Mare to shine a light on other music that has been overlooked in modern times.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. Tempesta di Mare performs the first Brandenburg concerto in a program that includes a modern premiere by the early 18th century composer Johann Friedrich Fasch, as well as works by Georg Muffat and Georg Philipp Telemann. Concerts are Friday evening at the Presbyterian Church of Chestnut Hill and Saturday at St. Mark's Church in Center City, Philadelphia. The Patterson Avenue section of South Philadelphia is best known as the home of the city's sports stadiums, great hulking structures representing a popular part of the city's identity and recent history. Yet in the shadow of these sporting venues is an institution that explores a culture that helped shape the very existence of Philadelphia and the surrounding region. Built in 1926 and nestled in Franklin D. Roosevelt Park, the American Swedish Historical Museum is the oldest Swedish museum in the country, and as WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer now reports, it today continues to offer reminders of a strong Swedish influence in the Delaware Valley.
Traces of Philadelphia's Swedish heritage are easy to find. Take a close look at the city seal, or flag of Philadelphia, with its three vertical stripes of blue, gold, and blue again. It bears a strong resemblance to Sweden's blue flag with its large gold cross. And this isn't mere coincidence, according to the Swedish Historical Museum's executive director, Tracy Beck.
That is all based on the fact that the Swedes were the first Western settlers in this area, and so their colors were sort of embraced by the state and the cities around here.
Decades before William Penn and his fellow Quakers arrived, a small group of Swedish settlers came to the region in 1638, forming the New Sweden Colony along the banks of the Delaware River in modern-day Delaware, Pennsylvania, and New Jersey. Kim Erik Williams, honorary governor of the Swedish Colonial Society and director of the Swedish Language Program at the University of Pennsylvania, says with the support of Sweden's King Gustav Adolphus, the motivation to start a settlement in the New World was simple.
The idea was to come establish a fort and then trade with the Indians, get enough furs that you possibly could, take them back to Europe and make money. And the only settlements you had would be a couple farms around the fort which were necessary for food for the soldiers to keep the place going.
Williams says New Sweden was small and never really prosperous. By 1655, it was taken over by the Dutch, who had another colony along the Hudson River, then known as New Amsterdam, and now, well, you know. Yet many of the Swedish settlers remained in the Delaware Valley, and still more Swedes continued to emigrate and make a new life in the New World. By the 1690s, there were about 1,200 Swedish-speaking people living in the Delaware Valley. The early Swedish presence in colonial America is illustrated in the grand lobby of the American Swedish Historical Museum. The towering ceiling displays a colorful mural depicting the first Swedish settlers interacting with Native Americans. Compared to other colonial powers like the Dutch and English, the Scandinavian settlers actually got along pretty well with the Native Americans, according to the museum's curator, Kerry Hogan, in many ways by necessity.
The Swedes were very judicious. They were always outnumbered in so many respects. So they played it safe. They traded very carefully. They were nonviolent.
An examination of the relationship between the Swedes and Native Americans is part of a current exhibition at the American Swedish Historical Museum called Colony to Community, The Story of New Sweden. The show was organized in conjunction with this year's 100th anniversary for the Swedish Colonial Society, another organization created by the museum's founder, Amandus Johnson, designed to preserve the legacy of the New Sweden Colony in America through research and publications. The Colony to Community exhibit includes Native American artifacts, a watercolor portrait of a New Sweden governor by N.C. Wyeth, a Swedish coin from 1645, and a variety of church artifacts.
We have here the Geneva Bible from 1599 that William Penn gave to Gloria Day Church in Philadelphia.
Kerry Hogan also points out silver communionware on loan from the Holy Trinity Old Swedes Church in Wilmington, Delaware. Precious items from Sweden given to the church in the early 1700s and still used today. Hogan says such objects represent the central role that churches played in sustaining Swedish culture in the region up until a period of mass immigration from Sweden to America in the 1800s.
And really what we're doing with this section of the church items is bridging the New Sweden Colony to today. Without the church community, we really wouldn't have a whole lot of continuity into the 19th century that we would see with when immigration occurred. There would be no infrastructure of Swedish community here had these churches not sustained this population with language and culture and food.
There are 24 historic Swedish sites still preserved in Pennsylvania, Delaware, New Jersey, and Maryland. They consist of 8 old Swedes churches, parks, a full-scale replica ship, and historic log cabins, another part of New Sweden's legacy. Kim Eric Williams says many of the first Swedish settlers came from heavily forested areas and helped introduce log cabin construction to America.
3 Swedish settlers, 3 men, could build a log cabin in a day. And that log cabin was good for 60 years. They were expert woodsmen. And this was a perfect sort of place to live in a country like America, which was filled with forests.
Along with examining the Swedish influence in America, Executive Director Tracy Beck says the Swedish Historical Museum also takes a look back at life in Sweden.
This is the stuga, which is a representation of what a one-room house in Sweden might have looked like. And so we have the corner fireplace that is typical of a Swedish home.
The Swedish Historical Museum houses 12 permanent galleries, including the stuga with its intricately stenciled ceilings and walls. There's a room that envelops visitors with a map of 17th century Sweden, painted on walls covered with bronze leaf, while another gallery is dedicated to the Nobel Prizes, founded by Swedish inventor and entrepreneur Alfred Nobel. Each year, the museum also hosts a midsummer celebration, a major summer solstice holiday in Sweden. It usually involves raising a maypole around which to dance and sing traditional songs. Kim Eric Williams says the holiday is all about daylight, something the Swedes don't always see a lot of during the harsh winters.
In December, you're getting 2 or 3 hours of light. But by the official midsummer, you have 24 hours of light rather than almost 24 hours of darkness. And so this certainly does call for a celebration.
William says in the U.S. today, descendants of the New Sweden Colony number between 20 and 30 million. Many are unaware of their Swedish roots because it's well over 10 generations back. Yet through passionate leaders, historic churches, scholarly research, and institutions like the American Swedish Historical Museum, the influential legacy of this first European colony in the Delaware Valley will not soon be forgotten.
WRTI's Jason Pfeiffer. And that's it for now. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at WRTI.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under Rossin Milanoff. Our executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.